Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nancy Solomon, filling in for Brian today. Last Tuesday, when New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced a plan to install cameras in subway cars, this somewhat puzzling line from her speech gained lots of attention.
You think Big Brother's watching you on the subways? You're absolutely right. That is our intent, to get the message out that we are going to be having surveillance of activities on the subway trains.
Wow. While cameras in subway cars haven't been installed yet, Hochul is right. Big Brother is already watching. Unlike the Orwellian novel, it's not a 24/7 surveillance through telescreens. Instead, we could potentially be identified with facial recognition, a revolutionary technology that has surfaced in the past 10 years. Police reform advocates have raised the alarm on this technology, saying it can lead to false arrests. One case in Hudson County has grabbed the attention of multiple organizations concerned by the threat to privacy or civil liberties that facial recognition software poses. Joining me now is Alexander Shalom, the senior supervising attorney and director for Supreme Court advocacy at the ACLU of New Jersey. Alex, hi.
Hi, Nancy.
So according to a CNBC poll or reporting, companies that make facial recognition technology have created databases of faces by collecting images, often without people's consent, from any source they can access. So what can you tell us about where they're getting this database of photos of faces?
You know, the interesting thing about this case, Nancy, is that I can't tell you anything. And that's really what the case is about. The case is about the fact that in order to defend himself, a person who was charged because of facial recognition technology wanted to know some of those questions, wanted to know, where do they get the database? Who's on the candidate list? Who's manipulating the data? What is the name of the software? Things as basic as that have not been disclosed to the defendant.
But we do know, right, that there are private companies that are selling people's data, which includes photos of their face that could come from social media, say?
Sure. We know that those are the possible ways that the databases can be formed. And what we just don't know in this case is, did they only use information from the Department of Motor Vehicles? Or did they also get things from the Department of Corrections? Or did they get things from Facebook? Or did they get things? There are endless possibilities. And all of those things impact the reliability of the technology. And to defend oneself in a very serious case, it's important to know those answers.
Right. So you just mentioned mugshots. So we're talking about people, obviously, who have been previously arrested. So how is this being put into use? Why do police officers need facial recognition? And how do they use it in conjunction with this database? You know, there used to be a book of mugshots, right? Like, how are they using it now in terms of fighting crime?
Well, so again, we have to just infer, because the NYPD is being scrupulously silent and not answering the questions that we think we're entitled to have answers to. But our best understanding is that the way the NYPD's facial identification section, FIS, works is they start with a probe image. That's the, you know, something that was maybe pulled from a surveillance camera or something like that. They take their probe image that they're trying to identify. But sometimes it has to get edited because probe images work best when their eyes are open, mouth is closed, and it's a full frontal shot right of the face. And so if the head is turned to the side or the mouth is agape or the eyes are closed, they might Photoshop it a little. At some point, they then take the probe image, maybe edited, analyze certain points and features to create what's called a face print. It's a kind of a formula, a mathematical formula, which again, we don't have access to. They take that and they run it against an unknown database. That will produce a candidate list, so maybe 100 people who look kind of similar to the probe image. They assign a numerical confidence ratio. You know, this person is a 94 and this person is a 92. And then a technician, again, someone we don't know, chooses which image counts as a possible match. The thing that's so interesting about that, Nancy, though, is that that list, that candidate list, is going to be filled with false positives. Because if it's 100 people, well, 99 of them are not the person in the image. And maybe 100, but at least 99 of them are not the person in the image. And so it's very important for a criminal defendant to find out who's on that list. Because in that list might be the actual suspect, the actual person who committed the crime.
Listeners, what are your concerns regarding facial recognition technology, especially when it's used by law enforcement? Do you work in law enforcement? If so, what can you tell us about the process of using facial recognition to identify perpetrators of crime? Lawyers, what is your take on facial recognition being used as evidence? Do you work in facial recognition technology for the public or private sector and have something to contribute to the conversation? Call us with your questions at 646-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So tell me, Alex, how this came onto either your personal radar or the ACLU's radar in terms of this potential threat to civil liberties.
So this is a case, as you said, that arises from Hudson County. It was a robbery in West New York. And they had an image from a surveillance camera, and they brought it to the New Jersey State Police. And the state police said, well, we can't find any matches. It's not a good enough picture for us to work with. And so the West New York Police Department went to the NYPD and said, hey, can you find someone? And NYPD ran it and through the process I just described, produced a possible match. And they went to two different witnesses to the crime and had the possible match, whose name is Mr. Arteaga, in the photo array. And both people picked Mr. Arteaga out, though after some hesitation, and one person had gone past him once and then came back, but they picked him out. And he was then charged with a crime, and he became represented by the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey. And they have a really terrific forensics team there who recognized that this was a novel issue here on how we deal with facial recognition technology. And so they filed an absolutely terrific brief. They got a court. They first thing they said is, we need some information. And the court said, we're not going to give it to you. And I can talk about their rationale there because it's really troubling. But they then took an appeal, and the court agreed to hear the appeal. And the Office of the Public Defender reached out to us at the ACLU of New Jersey and our colleagues at the ACLU National and the Innocence Project. And we together wrote a brief, and some other organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation put together a brief, and some of the world's leading experts in misidentification put together a brief, because everyone recognizes that this is new technology, but it's decidedly not science. It's more, rather than being akin to fingerprints, which are at least pseudoscientific, it is more akin to like a sketch artist. It might be helpful, but that doesn't mean it's always reliable, and we need certain information to test its reliability. And this case that we're litigating now is really about our access to that information.
Okay, that was a very good, clear explanation. I appreciate that, Alex. We're going to take a caller who I believe wants to challenge, you know, the way that you're describing the technology. We have Duane in Manhattan on the line. Duane?
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
So one of the issues that he brought up was that if there's surveillance photo produced from an investigation, I'm a detective. I've been a detective for years. And we've used this technology. That image, it isn't Photoshopped before it's parsed through the facial recognition software. It is whatever image that is obtained from whatever video surveillance that's around, that image is submitted to FIS, and it's whatever raw footage it is. the more footage that is available, the better. So yeah, it does include, you know, it does work best if someone's eyes are able to be seen or something like that. But it, the more footage of that person that's there, the better the software, of course, works. And of course, the better the quality of the image. Once that hit, if there is a hit that is generated from that image, from whatever other sources that are available, either through previous bookings or other arrest records that maybe the department has access to, the detective receives that hit. That hit, one of the first things they say is, this is not probable cause to arrest this person. And I want to make that very clear. The regular identification process that has to occur for identifying someone to generate probable cause, it still generally relies on a witness. It has, that image has to be presented to a witness with other similar witnesses in that photo array. And the rules, especially in the last few years, have been quite stringent as to how that photo is presented. If this individual is wearing a red shirt and he has an earring or something like that in the ear, then all the other similar images that are presented to the witness have to at best be presented in the same fashion. This is where sometimes photoshopping is used, not with the original photo, but with the subsequent photos that are presented to the witness so that all the images appear to be as similar as possible so that the person makes the best, is given the best opportunity to identify who is the perpetrator of the crime.
Okay, fantastic to have you on the show. I love that. I just love that you called. So, Alex, do you disagree with what Dwayne is saying?
No, I absolutely appreciate Dwayne coming on and his candor. I just wish we were able to get straight answers like that in the case we're working on, which is to say, one of the things we wanted to know is, was the image manipulated? And we were told we're not going to get an answer. And the reason we were told that is, well, because the NYPD isn't part of the team in West New York. But of course, we don't want to allow police agencies to outsource their responsibilities. They were asked to do a task. And as part of doing a task, they're required to give us certain information. And some of that information is the very stuff that Dwayne was talking about. Unfortunately, I don't think Dwayne's answer is going to be admissible in court, but it is certainly useful to know that the general policy of the NYPD is to not manipulate those images.
Now, it sounds to me like maybe what detectives do isn't so problematic, but it's more at the trial level. The problem is that information and about the source of this photo identification is not being shared with defense counsel. Is that the crux of it?
That's what this case is about. And it might be that there are some departments that do facial recognition searches in the way Dwayne described, which would be less problematic, and others where it's more problematic. But for example, we don't even know the software that they use in New York. We don't know how often it gets it right, how often it gets it wrong. And different agencies use different programs. And that sort of black box where we're depriving defendants and the public of that information is not generally how we approach criminal cases. We say that because we don't just want to win when we punish the guilty. We also want to ensure trials are fair. We want to prevent innocent people from being convicted. So we try and share as much of this information as possible. It's a rule that's been around in American jurisprudence for, you know, more than half a century. And that's what the fight is about now, getting enough information so that Mr. Arteaga can figure out whether the process used in his case was a fair one and one that led to the right result.
Now, there's a long history with photo arrays and lineups and witness identification. I mean, this goes back years, long before facial recognition technology. So I'm kind of curious how these two things play together, because I think it's largely misunderstood that that there are problems with photo arrays that are given to a witness, and that witness testimony is one of the largest contributors to wrongful convictions. So where is the interplay between the old technology and problems with it, meaning a photo, and the new technology?
They're deeply interrelated. And Duane actually alluded to some of this when he talked about some of the safeguards that have been put in place in recent years to minimize unduly suggestive identification procedures. And New Jersey has frankly been at the vanguard of ensuring that eyewitness identification procedures are as reliable as possible, which isn't perfectly reliable, but is nonetheless an improvement. But think about this, Nancy. Imagine the facial recognition technology produces 100 names, 100 pictures, and they take the one that they want to put in the array, and that person clearly is going to look something like the probe image, the suspect. If the other five images that they're asking the witnesses to look at aren't from that list, then they presumably aren't going to look that much like the suspect, even if they're wearing the same red shirt that Duane talked about or the same earring Duane talked about. And so it, in many ways, using facial recognition technology, unless you're being very careful about it, can lead to more suggestive identification procedures because you're putting in one person who looks similar to the suspect and five people who do not. So a smarter way, a more reliable way, would be to ensure that the filler images, the other five images, are also from the facial recognition technology generated list. Otherwise, it's natural that the eyewitnesses would gravitate toward the only facial recognition technology generated match.
We're talking about facial recognition technology and the criminal justice system with Alexander Shalom of the ACLU of New Jersey. So, Alex, why do you think that either, you know, the NYPD or the DA's office is so reluctant to share information about these practices on the surrounding facial recognition?
Because they haven't been told that they have to, frankly, and it's easier for them not to. And it's easier for two reasons. One, just a general, you know, who wants to go through the effort of sharing things like hit rates and failure rates and false positives and things like that. But the other is because it will give defendants ammunition to undermine the technology. And anyone who's looked seriously at that technology, and as I said, there's a whole brief written by our colleagues at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and a group called EPIC, that looks really deeply at this technology. But anyone who looks at the technology understands that it's an art, not a science. And I think DAs and police officers would like to present it to juries as if it were a science. And I think any information that they have to provide to defendants that undermines that fallacy, that scientific fallacy, they perceive as harmful to their interests.
Okay, we have Brandon from Keyport, New Jersey on the line. Brandon?
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm working on a film about a gentleman by the name of Nigel Parks. And Nigel Parks was wrongfully arrested because of an erroneous facial recognition match. And the reason that his name came up in this facial recognition match is because he had been arrested for a crime that happened nearly two decades prior. And because his face was in the system, he was arrested in a town that he had never visited for a crime that there was ample evidence to demonstrate that that it was somebody else. And even though it's a very clear-cut case, it's very clear that he didn't commit the crime. His case has been languishing in the courts for years now.
And is one of the problems have to do with race and the way that facial recognition software works with people of color?
Absolutely. And in addition to that, because of the way our criminal justice system works, there are more people of color in the system. And probability states that if you are looking at a database that includes many more people of color, that it's just more likely that a computer will choose one of those people that are in the system.
There was a 2018 study by the MIT Media Lab researchers about facial analysis algorithms, showing that the technology misclassified Black women nearly 35% of the time, while nearly always getting it right with white men. So, you know, there is some research backing up these problems. Alex, is that something that you've looked at, or the sort of racial disparities in the way that the recognition software works?
It is. And again, Nancy, since we don't know the exact software they're using, we can't be precise. But as you point out, the studies have actually shown that, generally speaking, facial recognition technology performs worse on people of color, on women, and on young people, as opposed to white folks, men, and older people.
Yeah, and there's our producer pulled up another other work by one of your colleagues, Cade Crockford, at the ACLU of Massachusetts, the Technology for Liberty Project, that called facial recognition surveillance technology racist and anti-Black. Cade wrote, "Since Black people are more likely to be arrested than white people for minor crimes, their faces and personal data are more likely to be in mugshot databases. Therefore, the use of face recognition technology tied into mugshot databases exacerbates racism in a criminal legal system that already disproportionately polices and criminalizes Black people." So, you know, is there a... The use of mugshots could be a problem as well, right?
Absolutely. And to be clear, Nancy, no one is suggesting that, you know, if you have a suspect, you can't ask a witness whether this is the person using a mugshot. That's not what Cade is talking about. What we're talking about is this sort of mass data flow where you look through hundreds of thousands of pictures to purport to do something. And when the data is rigged, as Cade points out, because to take New Jersey, for example, where before legalization, Black people were three times as likely as white people to be arrested for simple possession of marijuana. So if we're just looking at whose face is going to be in the database, even though Black folks and white folks smoke pot at the same rate, their faces, Black people's faces, are going to be in databases that rely on mugshots at disproportionate rates. And that, again, Cade's critique, which is spot on, doesn't even take into account the fact that the technology itself fails at a greater rate when dealing with Black people, when dealing with women, and when dealing with young people.
So what is your hope for this case in Hudson County? I mean, is it that just there'll be more transparency, and or does it sort of take a whack at more controls over the use of the technology?
Well, I think providing transparency provides that whack, which is to say, right now, operating in total opacity, there's this kind of mythology around facial recognition technology about its accuracy. And once there's more transparency and we can reveal some of the problems with it, then the mythology is stripped away and it becomes just another kind of mediocre law enforcement tool. And that is a really important step in regulating its use. New Jersey has talked, the Attorney General has been in discussions with stakeholders for over a year now about trying to put some limits on facial recognition. And one important step in that process is transparency, is ensuring that the people who are impacted by it understand what is being used and how it works.
Let's take another caller. We have Alan in Queens on the line. Hi, Alan.
Hi. So I used to work for a security camera company from 2013 to 2020. And I would recognize like my cameras like all over the city, or I would know what manufacturer it's from. So one of the problems that I see right now is the quality of the pictures itself. And you know, it's not as advanced as people might think it might be. Like all the security cameras that you see over town are probably really privately owned, and they're maybe, 10 years old or 15 years old or, you know, even 4 years old. But anyway, like if you ever take a picture with your smartphone, and the megapixels on those cameras are probably 12 megapixel or more, and if you look at what 4K television quality TV is at, it's actually like 8 megapixel. 1080p is 2 megapixel, and 720p is like 1.3 megapixel. So all the cameras that you see around the city, they're only about 2 megapixel. And if you've ever like taken a picture with your phone and you like digitally enhance it and zoom in, you'd notice that the picture quality is, you know, it just gets worse. It's everything's, you can't see anything. Now imagine what that must be like if you have a 2 megapixel camera or a 1.3 megapixel camera. Anything that you see that's digitally enhanced is just not going to come out very good. And that's probably why a lot of times like for facial recognition, it's just not going to be a good hit because the quality is just going to be so low.
Thanks for your call, Alan. Alex, any response to that?
Well, that's exactly what we're worried about. I mean, we know in this case that the quality of the picture was so low that the New Jersey State Police were unable to do anything with it. And so it kind of begs the question of how is the NYPD? Is it because they have a better system? Is it because they have a system that is willing to tolerate more error? And those are the very sorts of questions that defendants and the public are really entitled to know.
We'll leave it there. My guest was Alexandra Shalom, Senior Supervising Attorney and Director of Supreme Court Advocacy for the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Alex.
My pleasure, Nancy. Nice talking to you.